1920 Massachusetts. Two Italian immigrants were charged with armed robbery and payroll murder. They were put on trial though for their radical political beliefs and dodging the draft. They were both sent to the electric chair. Welcome, you're listening to Nightmare Somewhere. This episode covers the details of the trial of Nicholas Sarko and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. It is very interesting and loaded with anti-immigrant hysteria, which was ravaging the US at the time. And they had a bit more stacked against them than that. I hope you stay for a while and see that how at the end of the day, it isn't so much an issue of their guilt, more so it is the fairness of their trial. If you're anything like me, it will definitely have you thinking, just what chance did they ever have? The following contains distressing content and coarse language. Nicola Sarko and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were not anarchists and agitators when they arrived in America. They left Italy believing that they were headed to a country that offered more opportunity and chance for them to prosper. They were radicalized over the duration they were in the US. After they arrived to a country rife with unemployment and economic hardship. So masses of people were living in poverty and the government was not taking action. Vanzetti wrote a letter back to his sister and told her how America was not the same place that had excited his imagination. And quote, "America, dear sister, is called the land of liberty, but in no other country on earth does a man tremble before his fellow man like here." They became involved with the anarchist movement because of their frustration at how the government turned a blind eye to the suffering of the working class. The pair became dedicated followers of Luigi Galliani, an engaging leader. He was a militant anarchist who pushed for change and to overthrow capitalism and the government. The group of radicals pursued their vision by any means and had detonated bombs in the homes of business owners and government officials. In April of 1920, two men were walking down South Braintree Street, the main drag of the small town located south of Boston. The two men were a paymaster and a guard. They were carrying two boxes containing the payroll for a shoe factory. They were travelling from the company's office building to the factory, and the boxes contained $15,776 in cash. Two other men were standing by a fence and pulled out guns and fired at the paymaster and guard, killing them. Meanwhile, a car sped up to the scene and the killers jumped in with the cash and the gang quickly escaped. Payroll robberies were fairly frequent at that time, and for this one, the cops didn't have a lot of evidence to go by. Witness accounts described that the criminals appeared to be Italian. Police at the time were already investigating a similar crime that had taken place nearby in the town of Bridgewater. They noticed that there were some similarities. The perpetrators were a gang of men who looked Italian and fled the scene in a car. So they simply began to look into Italian men who owned a car. This led them to Sarko and Vanzetti, who had been identified after attempting to pick up a friend's car from a mechanic. And They were both arrested a few weeks later while travelling on a streetcar, what we would call a train. The arrest was for how the pair were suspicious characters. So that's not my description. That is the actual charge. They were arrested for being suspicious characters. They were brought in for questioning, but the charges weren't explained to them. The arrest and this questioning is something that I'll go into further very, very soon, as it is an important part of the evidence that was put forward during their trial. Right, so their trial began in May of 1921 and the jury selection was exhausting. It took several days for only 7 jurors to be selected. You see, the prosecution wanted to ensure that the members of the jury were all respectable, educated, and conservative members of the public. The defense did challenge this, but the judge denied those efforts. So I will go straight into the area of evidence that was put forward called consciousness of guilt. So a lot of the evidence that was on them is under the description of consciousness of guilt. To me, it comes across a bit like, if you can't find anything remotely circumstantial, then this is the sort of evidence you'd be clamouring for. It relates to any behaviour that might infer that they were men who were guilty, and importantly, guilty of murder. The following is what was put forward during their trial in this sort of evidence. So the first was their behaviour after the arrest, and this was dissected. Firstly, they were both armed, but this was not out of the ordinary during that time in the 1920s. Secondly, they behaved shiftly. Is that the right word? Shifty. They were shifty. That's better. One of the officers described how Sarko was making movements, and the movements sort of seemed as though he was going to reach for a weapon. The officer told him to keep his hands where he could see them. Thirdly, they lied to police while they were being questioned. So I'll remind you, they were not aware that they were under investigation for murder. They were told that they were arrested for being suspicious characters. Sarko and Vanzetti figured that the police must have brought them in because of their involvement in the anarchist movement and the bombings. And the lies they told diminished their knowledge and participation in that. That was the evidence in terms of the the guilt, the inferences of guilt. Oh, wait, no, it isn't. Bugger me. No. There's more. So this is another one. Their behaviour while they tried to collect the car from the garage. So the owners of the mechanic garage have been told that to contact the police whenever an Italian man came in to pick up a vehicle. So when Sarko and Vanzetti were at the garage, the owner's wife excused herself so she could go call the police. She explained that the men followed her into her home that was on the other side of the road, and this was put forward as being behaviour regarded as suspicious. It was consciousness of guilt. The thing that makes the situation so much worse is that their defence of this consciousness of guilt was to argue that no, they may have been behaving suspiciously, particularly during their arrest, but it was not because they were guilty of murder. So it was essential for them to disclose and in fact highlight their radical beliefs and their anti-government activities. The next area of evidence is the witness testimonies, and what a circus it must have been. There were 59 for the prosecution and 99 for the defence. If I were to try to explain how contradictory these all were, it would bore you senseless. I'll just stick to some key issues. One definitely was how the supposed eyewitness testimonies were either from people who had not been there at the time. So these are from people who had seen or said that they had seen men matching the description, but hours before or after the actual crime. I have no idea how that works. Or in different locations than the event. It's mental. But that is what many of their testimonies were. It's like, I saw a dude near a car and then 2 hours later this murder takes place. And I just felt that it had something to do with this man. Secondly, they were from witnesses who had been fairly far away, like on the upper floor of the shoe factory. I could go on, but the issue would be just the same. That issue is the inherent improbability of anyone being able to truly identify someone who is a stranger to them based on a quick glance from a distance and during a time of confusion. Oh, this I didn't really want to go into. The guns, right? So the prosecution claimed that the revolver found on Vanzetti was the gun taken from the crime scene, so from the guard at the crime scene. And the prosecution also said that Sarko's gun, which was a Colt pistol, was consistent with being the gun used to kill the guard during that payroll robbery. There was conflicting evidence though about that. The alibis for the two men were thrown into doubt by more bloody witness testimony. 13 witnesses testified or corroborated that Vanzetti was in Plymouth selling fish on the day of the murder. And Sarko had an even better alibi. So he had travelled to Boston to request a passport from the Italian consulate on the day of the murder. So this was supported by several witnesses, including an official from the consulate who testified that he rejected the photo Sarko had tried to use for his passport because it was too big. And that is why he remembered it. There was also a grey cloth cap with a torn lining that was found a day after the murders. The prosecution claimed that it resembled one owned by Sarko. They put forward that Sarko had hung his cap up on a nail while at work, which explained the condition that it was in, but the cap was a different size to others found in Sarko's home. The prosecution asked him to try it on. He said it was too small. Does that remind you of something? But the prosecution maintained that it did fit and yes, this was his cap. Right, this is the good bit. I really want to share this with you. Sarko and Vanzetti were very much put on trial as anarchists and men who were opposed to the commonly held values and as dangers to America. Also as dishonorable men who had skipped out on the draft. So when Sarko took the stand, he was able to testify. He took this opportunity to explain his attitudes and his behavior. What he said was pretty magnificent. It is extensive, so I haven't been able to include the entire length of it, but you'll get the picture. So he had been questioned on how he fled to Mexico during the draft, and did he love America? The prosecutor said what a vile thing it was to abandon the country that he supposedly loves. This is the question. What did you mean when you said yesterday you loved a free country? And he answered, "Give me a chance to explain." The prosecutor said, "I'm asking you to explain now." And does he? This is what he says. "When I was in Italy, a boy, I was a Republican. So I was always thinking that a Republican has more chance of an education to develop and build his family, to raise their child and give them an education too. That was my opinion. So when I came to this country, I saw that it was not what I was thinking before, but there was all the difference. Because I had been working in Italy, not so hard as I have worked in this country, I could live free there just as well. Work in the same condition, but not so hard. When I started working here, I worked hard for 13 years. I couldn't afford a family the way I thought I would. I couldn't put money in the bank or push my boy to school. I began to teach other men who were with me the free ideas. I see men who fight for a chance of education, literature, and free speech being arrested and sent to prison because the capitalist class are against that. There would be no chance. They don't want the working class to be educated. They want the working class to be low forever, to be underfoot. So sometimes I see the Rockefellers or Morgans give $500,000 to Harvard College and $1 million to another school. Every day I ask, who is going to Harvard College? They won't get the poor class. They won't have a chance to go to Harvard College. It goes further, and in response to leaving the US during the draft, Sarko says how, I work for the Irish. I have been working with a German fellow and the French and many others. I love those people just as I could love my wife and my people who received me. Why should I go kill those men? What has he done to me? He hasn't done anything, so I don't believe in no war. Right, so after this, sort of like almost, it reads almost like a manifesto, really. The prosecutor confirms that this is his answer. This is indeed Sarko's explanation into why he loves the USA. And get this. Then the prosecutor, the first question, did you intend to condemn Harvard University? Oh, that says it all, hey. Oh my gosh. I just like blurted my entire heart and brain out and you're like, what the fuck did you say about Harvard? Oh, yikes. So the prosecutor closed with this appeal. Pardon me. This appeal to the jury, right? So in closing, he probably rattled off a whole pile of stuff and then said, gentlemen of the jury, do your duty. Do it like men. Stand together, you men of Norfolk. And the judge, so the role of the judge is to help the jury navigate all that has been covered in the trial, to figure out what is relevant, what isn't relevant. And in Massachusetts at that time, the judge was not allowed to express their own opinion. It probably is the same now, yeah? Anyway, but in his advice to the jury, he dismissed the alibi evidence, highlighted their behavior after the arrest, and gave a disproportionate consideration to this consciousness of guilt evidence. They were found guilty and sentenced to death. I'll be back very soon. In the 6 years following their trial, there would be many attempts for a retrial. There was something, though, well, someone who blocked them all. Massachusetts law, at the time at least, gave the original trial judge the authority to decide whether or not to reopen a case on the grounds of new evidence. This was a big problem for Sarko and Banzetti, as the judge, his name was Judge Webster Thayer, had remarked to friends after their trial,
see what I did to those two anarchist bastards the other day? He was to deny 5 motions for a retrial. The defence appealed to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, but a new trial was denied. The governor for Massachusetts at the time, Governor Alan Fuller, created a committee to review the evidence and the conduct of the trial. The chair of the committee, feast your eyes on this, was the founder of the Immigration Restriction League, and he was also the president of Harvard University. No comment. Someone also confessed to the crime, but he was a criminal, so the confession wasn't given much attention. Their executions were scheduled for August 10th of, I believe it would have been 1927. But after a last minute stay of execution, these were rescheduled for August 23rd. So protesters and demonstrations against their execution were held around the globe, from Mexico, Germany, England, and Sydney. Outside their prison, close to 800 police stood guard, armed with machine guns, prepared for any possible retaliation. A vigil was held in Union Square, New York, but at midnight, the lights flickered at Charlestown Penitentiary. Nicola Sarko was the first to be executed, then Bartolomeo Vanzetti. They were both put to death in the electric chair. I was like, Charlestown or Charleston? Man, look, if I said it wrong, I apologize. I'm only talking like that because, believe it or not, bam, I'm at the end where I talk a little bit of gibberish. Charleston. I mean, I know that loads of places are Charleston, but I was like, Charlestown. I'll go with that. Anyhow, thank you. There is so much more I wanted to say and so much more that I wanted to explain, but it is hard when I've got around 2 listeners and my poor children, little blighters, they're wanting to go to the park. So I thought, I might just wrap it up there and take them out. Right. I might add to this episode a bit later on. I hope it has given you a picture, though, of, you know, the circumstances surrounding the trial. I've put the links that I use, so to the sites that I used, in the show notes, including the now famous article, The Case of Sarko and Vanzetti, which was published in The Atlantic, not The Ocean. I believe it is a publication of some sort. In 1927. It's boss. All right. Catch you later. Bye-bye.